Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, as usual, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it's great to be back from a nice 4th of July hiatus. We missed a couple of podcasts, but that gave us all a chance to relax and catch up, and yours truly included. And I had a great weekend with friends and family, and got a lot of exercise in, and a little bit of chilling and relaxing, saw a couple of movies, and I'm raring to go. Kind of missed the opportunity to share vital health information with you, so we're back, and we promise to provide you with daily podcasts on intelligent medicine going forward. A new innovation for today's podcast is that although we don't have the ability to take your phone calls as we do on the weekend edition of Health Talk. Health Talk is broadcast on the WOR radio network out of New York City. There are many affiliates across the country. You can go to WR710.com and get the schedule, or you can download podcasts of Health Talk. But on that program, we frequently field questions. That's what it's all about. It's open to access, and we provide an opportunity for our audience members to pose their medical dilemmas to me, and I get a chance to solve them on the air. Hopefully, that's of general interest to lots of people, because you never know. Could be something that you're suffering from, or you might be able to provide advice on a particular medical problem to a friend or a relative. Well, we're going to do that after a fashion here on Health Talk. We're eliciting questions that you can send to me at radioprogram@AOL.com. I don't guarantee that I'm going to be able to answer them directly. I'm not just an information emporium here, and I can't correspond with you all individually. But if we select your question, we'll put it on the air. We'll pose the question, and then I'll answer it on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. So today we're going to devote much of our time to answering a series of questions, interesting questions that I got from you over the holiday weekend. And this one comes to us from JCP. JCP must have been on my website at drhoffman.com. Just reading your article on above-mentioned condition, that would be atherosclerosis. You can find that article at drhoffman.com. And wanted to know about ultratriol, polycosinol, and niacin. And I also wanted information on sterols to treat unacceptable ratio of HDL and LDL in someone who has a cholesterol level of 162. That's pretty good, 162. But, quote, bad ratio of the other two. JCP doesn't specify what that ratio is, but, you know, look, it's possible to have a low cholesterol and still have atherosclerosis. It happens all the time. That's why total cholesterol is not necessarily a good way to screen for cardiovascular risk. So his or her cholesterol, 162, but the ratio is bad. A product called Cholestoff has been suggested. Cholestoff. Need info due to recent TIA. So clearly, this is a person, you know, despite a cholesterol of 162, this person has had a TIA, which is a transient ischemic attack. That's just a step short of a full-blown stroke. That means that there was a little bit of a neurological deficit, maybe some problems with facial numbness or inability to speak, or maybe some weakness in one or other of the extremities on one side. Usually it's one-sided. And then it abates, and abates completely. And usually on MRI, you can't see any evidence of a TIA because it's transient. It's an ischemic attack. It's transient. It goes away. But it may be a harbinger or a warning sign of a future serious debilitating stroke. So you don't want to take TIAs lightly. Need info due to recent TIA, but don't want to rush into the wrong thing. Definitely opposed to any invasive approaches, but who to trust? Thanks so much for any info, please, Dr. Hoffman. All right, so you know, when it comes to atherosclerosis, let's stick to the issue of, you know, what can you use to optimize your risk factors for atherosclerosis? Well, Unfortunately, studies have shown that niacin, while it may lower cholesterol, may not have a big impact on atherosclerosis. Now, you may say, well, how is it possible? You lower cholesterol, you're going to lower the risk. Well, not necessarily. That's one of the quibbles we have with statin drugs. While they lower cholesterol, they may not take care of other numerous factors which may influence your cardiovascular risk. So it's no 100% insurance policy, even if you get your cholesterol down, as can be seen here, because here's a person with a cholesterol at 162, but they've had a TIA. So niacin, maybe not the most desirable product. What about polycosanol? Well, polycosanol got a lot of play in the 1990s because of Cuban studies which showed that this derivative of sugarcane, and my goodness, they got a lot of sugarcane down in Cuba, right? That's where we used to get all our sugar from until Cuba went its way and we went ours. And now we extract most of our sugar from sugar beets in this country or from corn, making high fructose corn syrup. So very little of our sugar in America comes from sugar cane. So down there in Cuba, they did some studies on sugar cane. They found they could extract a substance called polycosanol, which they then experimentally applied to people who had high cholesterol. And the results were very, very impressive. Cholesterol dropped dramatically in people receiving polycosanol. And so for a while, polycosanol was recommended for people with high cholesterol. But then they did some studies where they looked at polycosanol in studies performed outside of Cuba. And to make sure that they got the good stuff, they actually got the Cuban material so as to avoid any accusation that, oh, that's not the right kind of polycosanol. It was actually Cuban-derived polycosanol. And what they found was that it didn't work. And the studies that actually show that polycosanol was not of any great benefit, they're actually pretty impressive. So around the time that those negative studies came out, my interest in polycosanol waned. You'll still find it available in some health food stores, but I don't think it's particularly helpful for lowering cholesterol. And by the way, you know, parenthetically on niacin, there's a type of niacin that's called no-flush niacin. It's niacin hexinositol. And I got to say, I just think that stuff doesn't work at all to lower cholesterol unless you take massive doses. I think a lot of people try to get the no-flush niacin, niacin hexinositol. That type of niacin doesn't really work even to lower cholesterol. And then the question remains, even if you lower the cholesterol, is niacin beneficial for cardiovascular disease? Some recent studies cast doubt on that. So what can you do besides that? Well, cholestoff is a product that has plant phytosterols in it. Plant phytosterols are a type of oily compound. They sound like cholesterol, right? Well, they're sterols that actually tend to block cholesterol in humans. And in fact, it's thought that the healthy effects of certain foods, particularly nuts, in terms of lowering cardiovascular risk, comes from their high phytosterol content. The product cholestoff is an example of a phytosterol compound. Also, I formulated a few years back with the Vitamin Shoppe a product called Advanced Cholesterol. And that product is a phytosterol product. It contains phytosterols and other ingredients. So clearly those products are a benefit in terms of lowering cholesterol. And actually, parenthetically, there's a nice article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks back, a new way to cut bad cholesterol. I love it when these newspapers talk about stuff that we've been talking about in the field of nutritional medicine for 10 or 15 years, and they say, it's a new way to cut bad cholesterol. All right, well, a decade ago, the article says, Brandeis University scientists found a way to put this naturally occurring substance into fats, such as butter substitutes. So they had what are sometimes referred to as phytosterol margarines. But there's a new method that they patented to make phytosterols disperse in water. And according to the Brandeis scientist Daniel Perlman, many individuals could achieve LDL reductions of 15 to 20% by ingesting moderate doses of phytosterols in foods. I have to say that my experience has been that the reduction is much more moderate, but maybe with this new technology to put more phytosterols in a soluble fashion into foods and beverages, maybe, just maybe, there's going to be a big breakthrough. According to Dr. Perlman, it would be hard to eat enough of it in nuts and vegetables to make a big difference. So the process relies on heat and glycerin to produce smaller particles that are more effective at binding with cholesterol. And this new form of phytosterol is better able to remain dispersed in liquids such as soups, dressings, and milk. So, yeah, look for functional food products containing phytosterols. Maybe that'll be a way to reduce the bad LDL for patients like JCP. But when it comes to TIA prevention, it's not just about lowering cholesterol or improving the ratio. By the way, if you want to improve your cholesterol to HDL ratio, it's actually not uncommon to see patients, even patients on statins, to have a bad ratio. And part of the problem is heredity. Some people just have low HDL. But if you want to raise your HDL, one of the best ways to do it is through a lower carbohydrate diet. That often helps you to increase your HDL. Actually, eating more eggs will cause your HDL to go up, and the ratio may thus improve. Your cholesterol may stay the same or go up slightly, but at least the ratio is improving, and the ratio may be a more important determinant than the overall level of cholesterol. In addition, exercise is one of the most reliable ways to raise HDL cholesterol. Niacin will do it too, but the artificial raising of HDL that occurs with niacin, scientists have been disappointed with that in terms of its ultimate effects on cardiovascular disease. So what else is helpful for TIAs? I would consider a course of chelation therapy. Intravenous EDTA was recently shown to reduce the risk of heart attacks in previous sufferers of heart attacks in a big study performed by the National Institutes of Health, a nearly $32 million study over a long period of time, nearly 10 years. And in the patients, especially patients with diabetes or patients who'd had a big anterior wall MI, there was a significant reduction in the risk of subsequent heart attack or the need to get Roto-Rooter or heart bypass surgery after an initial heart attack. So TIAs, also circulatory problem, may be amenable to chelation. I would also suggest things like pycnogenol, which enhance cerebral circulation. Pycnogenol, I think, is excellent for carotid artery blockage and ultimately helps the circulation to the brain. And, of course, you know, the full panoply of supplements that prevent atherosclerosis. I'm not just talking about things that lower cholesterol, but things that protect the arterial wall. Vitamin D may play a role, and vitamin K has an anti-atherosclerosis effect, and curcumin and green tea have anti-inflammatory effects. All these may be important. We can't forget fish oil, because fish oil, in a variety of ways, prevents vascular disease. It thins the blood. It reduces inflammation. It may have a beneficial effect on cholesterol ratios, not always, but sometimes, and helps to lower blood pressure. So lots of benefits to fish oil. So, you know, for someone who's had a TIA, I recommend, well, it sounds a little self-serving, but a nutritional consultation where we look at all aspects of your cardiovascular risk, including diet, getting you probably on a lower carbohydrate diet or a low glycemic index diet, at the very least, and that'll improve your ratio and reduce your risk of a subsequent TIA, or worse yet, a stroke. Thank you for your good question, JCP. Appreciate the opportunity to answer it. And now for a question from Len. Len writes, Dr. Hoffman, I like all your vitamins and supplements, but need to know specifically which may be detrimental to my kidney function. I am 70 years old, and every year my creatinine is going up, now 1.9, and my GFR is going down, It's now 46. All right, what's GFR? GFR is something called glomerular flow rate. The glomerular, that's a tough word. The glomeruli are the little tiny places in your kidneys where they're microscopic. And that's where the toxins get filtered out of your bloodstream and transformed into urine, which takes away your wastes. And a normal GFR, of course, it's age-related. You know, as you get older, your GFR tends to go down. Or if you're, you know, small in size, you may have a lower glomerular flow rate. Or if your kidneys are failing, you'll have a lower glomerular flow rate. Actually, a glomerular flow rate of 46 is not terrible, but a creatinine of 1.9, that's elevated. Creatinine should generally be lower than about 1.4, 1.5. And if they're above 2 or 3, there's a high risk of eventually going on to kidney failure. Things that, I mean, a variety of things that promote kidney failure or declines in kidney function, simply aging will do that. But you can mess up your kidneys with high blood pressure and or diabetes, double trouble when you have both together. It's certainly harmful to take certain medications. I've actually seen some patients have kidney failure just on the basis of taking too many painkillers, particularly non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Even modest doses of those actually can damage the kidneys. Tylenol as an alternative, but Tylenol can damage your liver. So pick your poison. So this is a guy, 70 years old, creatinine's going up, and he says, I fear dialysis and transplants. Thanks, Len. So let's talk a little bit about supplementation in patients with kidney problems. Now, as a rule of thumb, you can't do yourself a lot of harm even if you go willy-nilly through a health food store and buy yourself a bunch of stuff. It's hard to do yourself irrevocable harm unless you have a specific medical condition or, in particular, if you have declines in kidney function. Then you have to be careful because your body doesn't filter stuff out as well. And normally stuff which you can take plenty of, like magnesium and potassium, these generally are excreted well by the kidneys. But in patients who have the beginnings of a decline in kidney function, they can overaccumulate. So a caution flag, I mean, many patients who have mild kidney dysfunction do require a little bit of magnesium. But you can't go hog wild on magnesium because you can overaccumulate it. Particularly, you can overaccumulate potassium, so beware of potassium. Potassium can easily be measured on a blood test. Same thing with magnesium, and you can see if you're overloading. Most other B vitamins, for example, are pretty well tolerated. Calcium is pretty well tolerated, although you've got to monitor your calcium. One of the things that tends to go when you have kidney problems is your ability to synthesize vitamin D. And the vast majority of patients with serious kidney failure have deficiencies in vitamin D, and it's actually very hard to restore vitamin D. So part of the problem is that the vitamin D that you take gets transformed into an active form in your liver and your kidneys. And so if you're missing kidney function, you may have an inability to properly transform your vitamin D. So vitamin D becomes very important. And, you know, here's really, I think, a great argument. Once again, may sound self-serving, but I think people with renal function issues really should go to experienced medical nutritionists who have not just experience with helping people to lose weight, minor issues, but patients with serious problems, diabetes and kidney failure. Nutritionists who are properly certified and trained have experience working with hospitalized patients with these conditions. So they'll tell you what you can take and what you can't take and issue some cautions. Things that are helpful for declining kidney function, well, it's been shown that fish oil helps to slow kidney function, possibly because it reduces inflammation. And also, many patients who have declining kidney function benefit from N-acetylcysteine because it builds up glutathione. Glutathione is very healing in the body. And also Alpha lipoic acid can be very helpful for patients I have found who have declining kidney function. Patients who are with very serious kidney failure or even patients receiving dialysis may do very well with carnitine and coenzyme Q10. They tend to have real serious fatigue and often replenishing their coenzyme Q10 and carnitine really helps to transform them. They generally tolerate hormones pretty well. Many patients who have chronic renal failure have low levels of DHEA. The men have low levels of testosterone, and supplementing them with those, and these obviously need to be monitored by a physician, levels measured and the response monitored via blood tests. These are things that can often help restore vitality and energy in these patients who are highly depleted. But in general, it's a pretty good idea to get some nutritional guidance when you have the beginnings of kidney failure. Another thing that might be problematic in a person with declining kidney function is very high doses of vitamin C, because vitamin C, normally, you can take enormous amounts and it's excreted properly. But as you have declining kidney function, you have to be careful. This is actually something that I take note of when I give intravenous vitamin C. I can give very high doses to people who have normal creatinines. But if their creatinines start going up, then there's a caution flag about administering very high doses of vitamin C. Sometimes we give 25 or 50 or 75 or cancer patients as much as 100 grams of vitamin C, but in a patient who has a creatinine of 1.9, more caution is necessary to avoid the potential for, especially for kidney stones, which can occur in patients who have poor clearance of vitamin C. Here's an interesting question, but it's a little bit weird. The question is by Tomas. I don't know if Tomas is, this is just an email. I don't know if Tomas is sending this to us from a foreign country. Tomas, he may be from Portugal or Brazil, possibly Spain. Dear Dr. Hoffman, if you consider appropriate to comment in your Intelligent Medicine audio podcasts, this guy's too polite to be an American. With all the supplements that you take, have you ever had custom inconveniences in the American airports? Keep you the supplements with your hand baggage or with your checked luggage? Thank you. With kind regards. Yeah, this guy's obviously a foreigner because he's very polite and a slightly awkward construction of the question. Keep you the supplements with your hand baggage or with your checked luggage? His otherwise perfect English spelling and punctuation. Thank you, Tomas. So that's an interesting question. I have never experienced any difficulty bringing massive amounts of supplements through American airports, either checked or unchecked, nor have I had a problem going to foreign countries, although I've had some apprehension because I thought, like, oh my goodness, you know, what if I'm a clever drug smuggler and I carry so many supplements with me and all those little pills could be illicit drugs? But I don't know, maybe I've got an innocent face or I don't fit the profile. They look at my stuff, or in many cases, they don't even look at my stuff. They just x-ray my baggage and they don't even bother rifling through my supplements. Now, what I do routinely, I have many patients who, you know, they say, well, when I go on my trip, I'm planning a trip to Europe or I'm planning a trip to Africa on safari. They say, shall I take my supplements? And I say, yes, take your supplements. Absolutely take your supplements. And I suggest that they make little baggies, little individual doses of their supplements so that they're conveniently available for them to take on a daily basis. They don't have to take bottles and bottles of supplements, but at least make little baggies of the supplements that you need. Maybe it's for 10 or 14 days and take them along with you. And as a precaution, I issue a standard letter, which I then sign, saying that these are authorized supplements that have been prescribed by me. And should any questions arise at customs, there, feel free to contact me. And so far, nobody's gotten busted. Curious customs agent has called me on it and said, "Hey, I'm detaining your patient here at the Lagos International Airport, and they appear to have illicit contraband on them. Can you vouch for them?" That's never happened. So I guess not a big deal, but you know, it may be a little bit of a flaw in the system, because people are really minutely shaken down to make sure that they're not carrying contraband. Vitamins and supplements and medications appear to be relatively exempt from close inspection. Here's a question from John about our Intelligent Medicine podcasts. John writes on my Facebook page, "Doc, is there an index of your amazing podcasts? For example, today I was chatting with my sister and I told her you had great approaches to weaning people off of acid-lowering medication. But to find it, I need to play each podcast going back and poke around. How can I access your brilliant work more effectively?" And first of all, thank you very much, John. It's very gratifying to get positive feedback from people who enjoy these podcasts and find them useful. I'm going to answer this in a couple of ways. First of all, it's not necessary for you to poke around in each podcast. You can go to the podcast page at drhoffman.com, and there are succinct descriptions of each podcast there. So generally, if you're looking for something like, in this case, you want to find out about how to get off of acid-lowering medication, you would probably be directed to my podcast of a couple of weeks ago that I did with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin on the subject of gastrointestinal problems and special diets for various types of GI health disorders. And in that podcast, we discussed ways that we can get people off highly addictive acid-blocking medications. Very hard to wean. So that's a way that you can find the podcast you're looking for. Now, as an added enhancement to our podcasts, we're undertaking a full revamping of our website at drhoffman.com. We'll probably launch by the end of summer. And it's going to be a very, very transformed website where the podcast page will have indexing. So the indexing will enable you to put in a search term, and you'll be able to then be directed to podcasts that contain the type of information you're looking for. Now, we don't have a search that's based on audio. That'd be kind of a cool thing, where you could ask for a certain word and it would pull out all the audio of different podcasts every time that we mentioned gastrointestinal problems. But that can get a little confusing, because it's probably not a podcast that goes by that we don't mention gastrointestinal problems. But at least it'll match the podcast descriptions, and then you can search the podcasts. And you know, by the time we get done with revamping the website, there may be scores and scores of podcasts. And then as time progresses, people may forget that, oh, there was a great podcast and I heard it back last year. Where can I find that? You put the search term into the search box on the website, on the podcast page, and you'll be able to find the podcast that you're looking for. So there'll be lots of bells and whistles on the new website. We'll have all kinds of articles. I'll have guest contributors. And I think you're going to find it a very informative way to become a better and more informed listener. Here's a question from Bonnie, also on my Facebook page. And I endeavor to answer it in brief on my Facebook page, but I'll also answer the question here. Full disclosure, Bonnie is a relative of mine. And Bonnie writes, "I'm very confused and upset upon learning that skim milk adds sugar. I don't see that ingredient on the labels, but see 16 grams of sugar listed." So what Bonnie is alleging is that it's sweetened. It's artificially sweetened. And of course, she's looking for stuff that is sugar-free. And she's virtuously drinking skim milk in hopes that this will keep her trim. And then she's a careful label reader, and she sees that there's 16 grams of sugar in a serving of virtuous skim milk. Not much fat, because all the fat's been removed, but what, you know, instead of that, who needs all that sugar? So here's my answer to her. The sugar is not added. It's lactose, or milk sugar, which is actually two sugar molecules hooked together. It's what's called a disaccharide. Di means there's two sugars. So the milk sugar is lactose. Actually, one of the reasons people get diarrhea from lactose, they have lactose intolerance, is they can't cleave the two sugars into single or monosaccharides. And as a result, that disaccharide is too big to digest, and it kind of runs through you like an express train, pulling water out of your intestinal wall, causing diarrhea and lots of gurgling. And that's what lactose intolerance is. You lack the enzyme lactase, which cleaves the lactose disaccharide into its two sugar components, which are one molecule of glucose and one molecule of galactose. So much for your science lesson. Therefore, I write, low-fat milk can make you fat. If you guzzle it, which you tend to do, if you can stand the watery taste, because it actually provides less satiety than full-fat milk. So this is one of the big misconceptions, is that low-fat foods are preferable to full-fat foods, particularly when it comes to dairy products, because the fat is, yes, it's saturated fat, but the saturated fat has actually in studies not been shown to contribute to the risk of cardiovascular disease. This is something, you know, they've been saying on and on. It's don't eat saturated fat. Cut your saturated fat. Reduce saturated fat and cholesterol. Well, the saturated fat in dairy products, according to many big studies, it's now been shown not to contribute to cardiovascular risk. Why might that be? Well, if you don't have the fat, you're going to tend to consume more. And because of the sugar present, because what's left after you take out the fat, there's actually more sugar per serving. And the sugar may actually induce insulin resistance, which is a big driver of cardiovascular disease and potentially even cancer and inflammatory disorders. Insulin resistance is probably the single biggest common denominator of health problems that Americans experience. So we're doing ourselves in with this low-fat stuff. It tastes terrible. Most people do it just because they think it's more virtuous, not because they prefer it. The dairy industry makes out like a bandit with this, because they skim out the fat and then they offer it as cream, half and half, or cream cheese, and they get double the profits, because what is considered the swill that's left over after they extract the valuable fat, they can sell to you often at a premium, because there actually appears to be added value because it's low fat. It's one of the biggest industrial scams around. And so a bunch of people commented, Karen writes, Dr. H, you are such a wealth of knowledge. Who knew? And a bunch of people commented on this. I'm scrolling down. Mitchell, my other Facebook friend, writes, if you note, whole milk has fewer carbs than does low-fat milk for that sugar reason. And Lori then writes, and cream and butter have no carbs. So depending on your metabolism, and many people have carbohydrate intolerance to a greater extent than fat intolerance, skim milk is not that beneficial. There's not a great advantage in utilizing skim milk over full-fat milk. And the same thing with your ice creams. Generally, if patients are going to have ice cream, I suggest a premium full-fat ice cream, because you'll tend to eat less. And yes, there's sugar in ice cream. And ice cream, no way, no how, if you're trying to lose weight, it's not a good deal. Keep people away from ice cream. But if you want to consume ice cream on occasion, moderately, I suggest full-fat ice cream, because at least it's going to provide you with some satiety. And skim ice cream or ultra-low-fat ice cream, it's going to be much easier to go through a full pint or a full quart because there's less satiety value and there's more sugar, ultimately, which can drive your blood sugar crazy. And Kathleen writes, any suggestion for supplements to help speed the healing process after bad sprains and torn ligaments? Okay, so when it comes to sports injuries, there's the Rice principle, which is rest, ice, compression, and elevation. These are some things that tend to help. So obviously, you know, refrain from further exertion that can exacerbate the injury. Ice it down, because ice actually tends to reduce swelling and inflammation. Use some compression, maybe put a compression bandage around the ankle or the knee or the thigh involved. And consider elevation because, you know, you stand on your feet all the time, the blood's going to flow down and it's not going to flow up that efficiently and the swelling will worsen. Okay, so that's basic management for an injury. Other things that can be helpful, it turns out that when you have an injury, it's actually good to take vitamin C because there's, according to studies, there's less of a tendency for an injury to become a very serious neurological problem, very serious pain problem called regional pain syndrome, or used to be called RSD, which is just a agonizing serious pain problem. Sometimes after a serious ankle sprain or fracture, you can develop that. And it turns out that vitamin C has a preventive effect. Consider some of the following nutrients. Curcumin is a wonderful anti-inflammatory. In some studies, it's been shown to help tendonitis. In one study of tennis elbow, it proved effective. And there are very few things that actually help hasten the resolution of tendonitis. Tendonitis can be a nagging, persistent problem, as any sufferer of tennis elbow will attest. It is helpful to use what are called proteolytic enzymes. And one of my favorites, it's from Europe, it's called Wobenzyme. Wobenzyme actually helps to break down some of the protein and fibrin residues that accumulate after an injury and sort of digests them away. It's like meat tenderizer, in a sense, but works inside the body. Generally, when you want to take Wobenzyme, you take four times daily away from food. I've done this in a concerted and disciplined way, and I think I've healed some injuries pretty quickly. It's a real standby for athletes in some of the countries of Europe because it's actually originated in Germany and is popular throughout Western Europe. The product's called Wobenzyme, and it also contains bromelain. And we actually have another question about bromelain that I'll answer in just a moment. So bromelain, think bromelain for injuries as well. There's a couple of topical things you can do. Toprosin is a nice product for to apply topically or superficially to areas of injury. And can help to, it's a homeopathic product, but it's very good. It can be used for, there's a foot product for foot injuries. There's a general product for ordinary muscle injuries, muscle tears, and sprains. Toprosin is spelled T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and it's been a previous sponsor of my Health Talk program. So another of my Facebook friends, Lorraine, writes me a question about bromelain. Lorraine writes, you have written and spoken on so much about the benefits of bromelain helping with recovery from surgery. Does it have any blood thinning effects? Well, if you think about surgery is like deliberately inflicted trauma. So what applies to trauma also applies to surgery. And bromelain actually has a good reputation when it comes to injury and surgery. It is an ingredient in Wobenzyme, And actually, any of the other bioflavonoids can be also helpful for reducing swelling, particularly things like pycnogenol, if you have an injury. So that's part and parcel of that. But bromelain is different. Bromelain is a mixture of enzymes that digest protein that are found in pineapples. Pineapples have actually been used for centuries in Central and South America to treat indigestion and to reduce inflammation. And bromelain was actually first isolated from the pineapple plant in the late 1800s. In Germany, they've got something called the Commission E, which is a university commission that studies the efficacy of natural therapies. It's kind of cool. And they actually have approved bromelain to treat swelling and inflammation after surgery, and in particular sinus surgery, which is a very traumatic kind of surgery. If you've ever seen someone after a nose job or a rhinoplasty, you see that their face is tremendously swollen. And after sinus surgery, same thing happens. It is particularly effective in reducing inflammation from infection and injuries. And actually, some studies suggest that if you have sinusitis, it actually helps the antibiotics to penetrate more deeply into your tissues. So the issue, though, is bromelain a blood thinner, and therefore it might be precluded in surgery? And actually, I haven't found that to be the case, although if you look at some supposedly authoritative websites, they say, oh, don't take bromelain for 2 weeks before surgery because it thins the blood and might increase the risk of bleeding. I don't believe that there are any studies that show that is true to any great extent. And you might do well to begin your bromelain a couple of days before your intended surgery. It's hard to anticipate when you're going to have an injury, but you know when you're going to have surgery if it's elective. And then to continue your bromelain for 10 days or 2 weeks after your surgery. I don't think it's going to increase your risk of bleeding. And in fact, the commission-y study from Germany found that it was safe and effective in treating post-surgical inflammation and swelling. So best taken 80 to 320 milligrams 2 to 3 times per day. For injuries, 500 milligrams 4 times a day in an empty stomach. You can go pretty high on bromelain, and it's generally quite safe and effective in reducing swelling. Many cosmetic surgeons are aware of the benefits of bromelain, and they'll tell patients to take it in and around the time of surgery to accelerate the healing process. Okay, well, that was fun answering some of your questions. And remember, if you have a question and you want me to address it here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, just email us the question. Email it to radioprogram@AOL.com, radioprogram@AOL.com. That's also the place that you'll go to. You'll send us an email if you desire to be on our newsletter mailing list. We send out a weekly newsletter on topics of interest, and it's quite popular. We've got a lot of subscribers. We'd love you to join us. Until the next time, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.